disappointment?
Be less hard on myself.
It's a tall order.
I don't know if you all have heard, the story about the first time His Holiness the Dalai Lama heard about self-denigration, self-hatred in our culture. And so it was a meeting with that he had with some psychologists, and he was starting to meet with Mind and Life and some other groups to kind of work to really, he was curious about Western culture, and they were curious about how to, and it was actually psychologists and Western teachers, that was it. And they were talking about a particular meditation, and they were explaining, they asked His Holiness, well, how do you work with it when people come up with, just come in touch with this sense of unworthiness and self-hatred and being so hard on themselves? And he didn't even understand the question at first. It was pretty wild. He kept asking the translator, what are they saying? What are they asking? And then he realized that in that he had come from the intact Tibetan culture, right? Because it was the first generation that had come out of Tibet, and they just didn't have that. Can you imagine, like, what it would be like to live in a culture where people weren't hard on themselves? And yeah, can you imagine living in a mind and heart where you weren't hard on yourself? Okay. Anything else that you want to add to the list of what you?
Staying after 6 weeks, they wanted to have peace.
Some peace.
Remembering what's really important.
Cool. All right, thank you. You know, when you go, if you want to learn a musical instrument, you decide you want to play the piano, and you know you want to walk out of those lessons playing the piano, what kind of teacher do you go to? A piano teacher. Or you go to piano classes, right? Mm-hmm. You don't go to a piano teacher, take piano classes and piano lessons to learn the flute. So it's kind of the same here. It's really good to get clear on, like, why am I here? What do I want? And to know, then, you know, can the teacher teach this? This is the right class to be in. Because the clearer you are, then, A, you really get in touch with your own motivation. And that's kind of fuel for your own spiritual practice and for putting it into your life. And then also, you get to evaluate, like, is this working for me, right? And then it helps me, because then I can kind of refer back to this, and then we can all kind of, as a community, we kind of have shared, we start to share this community vision of where we're going and why we're here and what we want to be doing. So you can go back to wherever you were sitting comfortably here and stay where you are, whatever you want to do.
So you can tell me, go back where I came from.
Go back. Before you run and talk a little more. Okay, so the course overview is, first of all, is just kind of why are we here? And a little bit of an overview of the general thought and philosophy of Tibetan Buddhism. And then my plan is that we will do a meditation and some basic meditation instruction every class. So it'll have two components, and we'll talk more about that. And then the second class, we'll talk about the Buddha teaching the Four Noble Truths, which are really the basis of everything he taught. And one of the things that we haven't explored in our community so much is the Eightfold Path. So, and that's a way to really take what the Buddha taught into our daily lives. And then we'll probably continue on in the third class with the Eightfold Path and really talk more about some practices to bring it into our daily life. And because there are eight of them, I mean, you could spend 8 weeks on the Eightfold Path. So, well, but again, we'll be really focused on how can we use this in our lives. And then on the fourth class, I thought we could explore who supports us. You know, how do we, well, teachers, like what are teachers? How do we use teachers? How do we choose a teacher? How does a teacher choose us? Things like that. And then what about centers? How do we relate to a center? Like, I'm always impressed when new people come anywhere. I just recently went to a new center and spent a few weeks there. And it reminds me every time that I do that of just, there's a level that I experience of anxiety of, what is this? And who's going to be there? And then I walk in and I assume that everybody that I see when I walk in has been there forever and I'm the only new person. You know what I mean? And then after I got to know them, I realized, oh, you who I was talking to the first night thinking you knew everything, you came here 24 hours before I did. You know? And so it's really great because it helps me realize that we're all a community and it doesn't, and so you're looking around here, I'm guessing, and we don't know, you know, we're already here. This is our community. But it's just that sense of, okay, so how do we come together as a community and a center and how do we relate to that? How do we get support from it? How do we support each other? And then what I'm talking about there too, I have in here, is my meditation, is really opening the heart of compassion as the meditation. And who supports us? I thought I'd also talk about just a little bit about the historical juncture of Buddhism in America, especially in Tibetan Buddhism. And then the fifth class, I put cutting suffering off at the root. Anybody want to get rid of suffering in their life? Like, all right. And again, continue with Tonglen meditation. And then the sixth would be going forward and going deeper. Like how, this is great. We've got some basic tools to develop these things that we talked about. Now, how do we go deeper? And how? What if we want to really now dive into Buddhist thought and Buddhist practice? What are our options, especially in Sacramento? And then I thought I would introduce the Lojong meditation, which was designed hundreds of years ago for busy people and mind transformation. How's that sound? So one of the things that I can say about Tibetan Buddhism and what the Buddha taught is one of his best-known quotes is, be a lamp unto yourself. Work out your own liberation with diligence. So what does that mean? I think in our lives, especially as independent Westerners, and what I mean by Westerners is I think wherever we come from, we've been touched by Western culture now, right? That to understand that you, each one of us, already has the heart and the wisdom and the essentials to be deeply engaged with the transformative spiritual path. Okay? And so to understand that the power for that doesn't lie outside of yourself, and that everything that's presented here is just to help remind you and bring it out and to help support each other bring that out. So the Buddha, like I mentioned, started teaching 2,600 years ago, and he actually started with the very fundamental core elements that developed over the centuries into an incredibly complex system that, for instance, the Gelupa Tibetan Buddhists studied for 20 years in great detail, right? And longer. So that is pretty, so you can really go and get as much or as little detail as you want as you get into Tibetan Buddhism. There are basically three main types of Buddhism since the Buddha taught. The first one is Theravadin, which is when you hear about Vipassana. That's where that is. That was mainly in Southeast Asia. Then there's what's called Mahayana, which was where the Bodhisattva ideal came in, which is the idea that through our group Buddhist path, it's all about serving others and taking care of the others and really developing this heart of compassion, which gets expressed in, may I reach awakening as fast as possible so I have all the tools to help others do awaken as quickly as possible themselves. And then Tibetan Buddhism in Tibet developed what's called Vajrayana. And Vajra means an indestructible diamond. And Yana, again, means path, or it literally means vehicle, but often it's now thought of as path. Why vehicle? It's like the vehicle that carries us to success. Okay? It's the path that we walk. And I was thinking, well, what does Vajra mean here? It can mean so many things. And today I just wanted to throw out this idea that we all, I believe, have this deep yearning for meaning in our lives. You know? And we may give that other names. We may call it ultimate truth or value or love or non-dual awareness or bliss or ecstasy. But I think it all stems from this feeling that when we've got enough money in the bank and our stomachs are full and we've got a roof over our heads and we live in relative safety, that we begin to question, right? We begin to really often feel this longing for something deeper and something more. And as I was thinking about it, I realized when I felt that, I remember this was a long time ago, and the response was kind of like, you're being a little pie in the sky. What makes you think there is something more, right? What makes you think there is something that's bigger or more meaningful? And recently I came to see or really believe that our yearning actually means is exactly what shows us there is something more. Like, we can't really long for something that doesn't exist in a certain way. So there's like some way inside of us that we've already had experiences that shows us it can be different. And we already have a sense that we really care and we want to live a meaningful life. We want to be engaged. We want this to be full of purpose. And so if there wasn't that something more was possible, how could we even be aware of it and long for its return? Do you know what I mean? Does that kind of make sense? A little roundabout way. So in Tibetan Buddhism, there's what's often called the foundation or our ground. And it's just like we need a foundation or a ground to build a house on. So you could have all the materials in the world, right? You could have the best wood and the best carpenter and all the best fixtures. But if you don't have a ground or a foundation to build that house on, it ain't going to get built. So, and on the flip side, if you have a ground and not great materials, you can still build a house. Right? So the ground's essential. And here I'm thinking about how the ground is really what it is we're yearning for, and that's what's called our Buddha nature. And it's that sense that we already have all that's necessary for that deeply transformative spiritual life. And what it is it's our inborn potential really to wake up, to create and cultivate and have a heart of peace and awakened, vivid engagement with our lives and deep, meaningful, heartfelt connections with each other, and to lead the most deeply meaningful life. And so when we begin to get in touch with that ground, that sense of our Buddha nature, to wake up to ultimate reality, to wake up out of this kind of trance and dream, then when that happens, when we begin to see that and begin to just even get a sense of ground and really believe in that heart we had as kids where we really knew and believed in
what was possible in life, right? We weren't afraid to dream big then. Then, even when we feel unworthy and totally unlovable and like we're the most worthless creature in the world, the lowest of the low, which I think I can say I've spent some time there, I don't know about you, that you realize that no matter what's coming up that way, it never takes away the truth of our own inherent Buddha nature. There's nothing that can destroy that. There's nothing that can harm that. It's no matter how you feel right now, how schmucky or unworthy, it doesn't matter. Our basic nature is really of awakening, connection, compassion, love. It just is. And what that actually means, we go into in great detail with as we study Tibetan Buddhism. And then this question inevitably comes up, well, if that's true, how come I don't feel that way, right? Like, if that's really my true nature, why is it I don't feel it? And what it is what it says in one of the Buddha's teachings is it gives this analogy of just like the clouds on a really cloudy day. We just came through seasons of rain after rain and clouds after clouds, right? That you couldn't see the sun sometimes for days on end. You just saw the clouds. And they say that the Buddha nature is concealed in the same way that the sun is behind the clouds. And the Buddha put it like this. He said, "This mind, O monks, is luminous. Only it is covered by adventitious obscurations." Right? Adventitious obscurations. What the heck does that mean? So we get to study that too. But basically, adventitious means something that takes advantage, right? So it's like there's something creeping in there that's taking advantage of our nature as well, of us being human beings, of having this mind and heart that we have. And it's obscuring our natural, luminous, awake, aware, connected, compassionate, peaceful, loving, omniscient Buddha nature. So that makes us hard to see. But here's a question. When it was raining for days on end, especially if you're not me, I grew up in Oregon, so I'm one of those really weird people. When it's cloudy for days on end and it's raining, I'm rejoicing and I'm kind of doing this inner prayer, may we have another day of cloudiness and rain. Now, I've talked to other people who are like, oh my God, when's the sun coming out? But did you ever think that the sun didn't actually exist when you couldn't see it? Yeah. So that's the metaphor. It's just because we can't see it, it doesn't mean it doesn't exist. And just like when the sun's behind the clouds, we have a sense that it's there. We can feel it through the clouds. That's very much like our own inner potential. It's like we can feel it. We can sense it. It breaks through. And so because of that, we can, even when we can't see it, we can trust that it's there.
Yeah. Even the clouds are made seen by the sun, right?
The clouds are maintained by the sun.
Made seen by the sun. Even the clouds that cover the sun is made seen by the sun.
Oh, I see what you mean, yeah. Like if the sun wasn't there, you wouldn't see the clouds because it would be dark. Yeah, good point, I like that. So even it's our Buddha nature in and of itself that it exists that even allows us to see the obscurations. Well done. So I was thinking about how one of the metaphors for spiritual transformation that we hear a lot is that we cocoon. Like, do you know what I mean? Like you go into a cocoon and you become and that different. And that as, have you ever, how many of you have done that thing where you take a caterpillar and you put it in some kind of, what are those called? container terrariums.
Habitat.
Pardon?
Little habitat.
Little habitat. And then you feed it, and then you watch it become a cocoon and then a butterfly. So there's this really popular sense of spiritual transformation is like that. That like we have a cocoon around us, and then inside something's happening, and then we break out as butterflies, right? And the flip side of that is that as we do that, in the beginning, our cocoon is really our own habitual familiar patterns, right? Our own egoic familiar thoughts and behaviors and so on, and they serve us in some way. And that's the early stages of our spiritual development. And then as we go on, whatever that is starts to feel too tight, right? It's like, maybe it's even more like when a snake sheds its skin. Like you start to grow, and that thing that's holding you is just feeling like a one size too small set of clothing. And then, you know, and it almost creates this pressure, and we start to feel like we're like squeezed, and we're getting more and more squeezed because we're like living in too small of a space for what's growing inside of us.
The other thing for me has been more like the inner dissatisfaction of life. So I get my game going,
uh-huh.
I can do my number, I get through life, I finally manage to do that. It's not great, but at least I'm getting through semi-functionally. But then the deep dissatisfaction that you spoke about,
yeah.
is the inner motivator. It's like, you know?
Yeah. So that thing that if I'm hearing is what you're saying is that I think you're talking about that same discomfort, which is that dissatisfaction, right? So it kind of like you wanna change something.
It makes me come to places like this.
Yeah, yeah.
Right.
And that's it. That's the whole thing. Is that we're living in too small a space, but it's kind of scary to change, and it's kind of hard to change, and we don't know how to change, and we don't know how to open that up. And often, because it feels so safe to stay in our cocoon, we need a prod. Yeah, like we need something to prod us, to kind of get us going, to light the fire under us, to change. So, I think I just want to invite you, I was thinking of a whole contemplation, but I just maybe invite you to just think about, over the next week, like, where is it in your life that you're feeling that dissatisfaction and that uncomfortableness that might, and in two ways. One is that you feel like you're growing bigger than your cocoon and it's kind of ready to stretch. Like, where really is that in your life? And then also, where are your prods coming from, right? Where is that? Is it outside or is it inside that there's some sense of dissatisfaction or suffering or need or yearning, and what does that look like for you specifically? And so it's a really, I think it's a good question to kind of think about and journal with and look at, because you may think, well, what does this have to do with Buddha? Well, that's exactly what happened with the Buddha in his story. He was a prince. He had absolutely everything. He had no need of anything. And then he went out four times from his palace, and he saw someone who, a monk, who was sitting in deep peace and contentment. And he saw, that was the last thing he saw. He saw an old person, he saw a sick person, and he saw a corpse. And that, those were his prods. That was like, wait, this is a really cool life. I've got everything. I'm the prince of a palace, the only child, the only son. And not only that, his parents had been told he would either become a great world leader or a great spiritual sage, and they wanted him to be a world leader, so they kept just giving him stuff, right? Like, let's keep him happy and not allow him out into the world to become a spiritual being. And so those were his prods that got him out of his comfortable palace, outside the walls of his palace. So what is it in your life that's really prodding you, getting you, right, to go outside your cocoon, your comfort zone. So that's my invitation to you for the week. Let's take a 10-minute break. And yes, I am, as usual, way behind. There you go.
Perfect.